You are now listening to Conversations with Congressman King. Discussion on issues that impact your life with your representative from Iowa's 5th District.
Welcome to Conversations with Congressman King. This is Steve King, and we're here with Colonel Chris Hughes from Red Oak, Iowa, who's now the U.S. Army liaison to Congress. I count it as a fortuitous coincidence that we can come together here. Fellow Western Iowans, the background that you have, Colonel, starting out at Red Oak, Iowa, and part of it over at Office Air Force Base, and growing up in the military family, but also spreading your talents across the country and across the world. Welcome to Conversations with Congressman King.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to be here.
Colonel, it's a pleasure to be here with you and a chance to take up this conversation and expand it from the previous conversation that we've had. I talked then about your record that you have compiled in your years in the Army, 24 years, and some of those things are the Distinguished Graduate of the National War College, Chief Army Current Operations, Member Army Initiatives Group, the co-founder of the Army Improvised Explosive Devices Task Force, the IED Task Force. You're the founder of the Iraqi Advisory Task Force, the founder of the CJCS Guardian Anti-Terrorism Magazine. You're co-author of Fresh from the Fight and the author of War on Two Fronts. That sounds like a lifetime's worth of work packed in kind of in your spare time, Colonel.
Yes, sir. It's enjoyable stuff to do, sir, and I that is probably my hobby. I don't play golf, so I spend time writing.
Well, I think that this record that you put together is quite impressive, and I wanted to take up the conversation about we talked earlier about your experience in the Western Hemisphere and in Central and Southern America with the task force down there. As the Admiral Stavridis, did I say that right?
Stavridis, yes, sir.
Stavridis, as he was South Command, Regional Commander of Central America, and you had the only joint task force in the United States in that area, 2,200 people you're responsible for.
Yes, sir.
But you also commanded a unit that was engaged commanded a battalion that was engaged in 7 major battles during the liberation of Iraq. And how that happens and how you go through that and the difficulties that you have. Could you tell us a little bit about, first, what it was like to be given that order and to know that you were going to lead in that liberation of those segments of Iraq, and how different it was in the reality versus what you anticipated and what you were trained for?
Well, sir, you know, you spend to get an opportunity to command a battalion in the United States Army, it takes about 18 years of training. 18 years of experience and training, and that's when they finally decide whether or not you're going to be given the opportunity to do that, because you lead about 1,100 young men, and not only do you lead 1,100 young men, but you have about, today's Army, you have about 600 wives and about another 300 children, because we're a very family-oriented service, and the fact that even my wife is expected to be a part of the command team, and so when we're deployed, she is responsible for taking care of all of those children, those family issues while we're gone. And the Army actually sends her to school down at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, to learn how to do that. Nothing that I did, though, in those 18 years can actually prepare you for the day that they tell you to attack. And when we were outside the city of Najaf on the 30th of March, after plowing through the desert for about 54 hours to try to get in a position to do so, it's a very, very... a heavy burden you carry for those troops that are under your command, especially when you've trained with them for 2 years to do something of that. So you not only just carry the lives of those soldiers on your back, but you have those families that are back home and those children. And so the mission does come first, but your soldiers always come, you know, they always come in your heart in order to do as much as you can to accomplish the mission and to reduce those casualties as much as you possibly can. And the Army teaches us to do that by being thinking people. We love to teach how to think, not what to think. And so going up on that hill, I was pretty much left on my own to figure out how to do it right, accomplish the mission, and take the least amount of casualties of doing it. And I will tell you, to the credit to the tremendous men and women that I commanded that particular day, we accomplished all of our tasks and came back, and we had not taken a single casualty during that first battle.
I was afraid to ask that question, Colonel, and I'm glad that you had volunteered that response. To go through that first battle without a single casualty, I would have to believe you said a prayer of thanks when the sun set that day.
Oh, yes, sir. But I will tell you what, there's one of the reasons that I'm here and one of the reasons I'm proud to be up here working with you all is that Congress allowed something like that to happen. I never could possibly have imagined the resources I had available that day that I didn't have to expend human life in order to accomplish that mission. Sir, I had B-52s at 25,000 feet. I had Hornets from an aircraft carrier at 15,000 feet. I had F-16s at 10,000 feet from the Air Force. I had A-10 attack Warthog aircraft on the deck from the United States Air Force, Apache helicopters, OH-58 Delta helicopters, artillery, and I had all of those resources as a battalion commander to bring to bear against the enemy before I committed one single soldier up that hill to take that particular position that day. So because of the United States Congress, the U.S. people, and providing me the resources, I'm able to fight a battle and do what Sun Tzu said. You know, I win a battle without losing human life, win a battle without fighting is probably the acme of skill for a soldier. So in consequence, the next day, when I brought that same force to bear, the enemy relented, and we walked into the city standing straight up and, again, did not take another casualty.
That was Najaf?
Yes, sir.
You quoted Sun Tzu, and I'm frantically scrambling in my BlackBerry here because I have the verbatim of him in here.
I was so impressed with
the way he said that, and I know I have it right here, so I've stalled just long enough. Sun Tzu, this is, I think, the quote you referenced. He said, "Supreme excellence in warfare lies in destruction of your enemy's will to resist in advance of perceptible hostilities."
That's right. And he goes on to say, "To take a city without a fight is the acme of skill." Because when he was a soldier statesman, I mean, interesting, back in those days, you know, 4,000-7,000 years ago, those folks who were doing things like Genghis Khan, they were not only the soldier, but they were the statesman. And they knew when they took a city, they had to control the city afterwards. And so Sun Tzu was one of those guys that we read extensively before the invasion because we knew, yes, you got to beat the enemy on the hill, but the next day you have to communicate with the local cleric, you have to communicate with the mayor, you have to get the city to come under your control. But if you kill everybody on the hill or all of their family members, you'll never win over a city like that. So showing restraint, showing respect, showing cultural awareness was very important for us during the invasion. And I think we did it fairly well.
You're listening to Conversations with Congressman King, and we're here with Colonel Chris Hughes from Red Oak, Iowa, currently now the Army liaison to Congress and a veteran of a number of different missions, including the liberation of Iraq, which we're in the middle of discussing. And the Sun Tzu quote, "And to take a city without a fight," I wanted to have some conversation with you, Colonel, about the object of war, which you've articulated here. And we could go to Clausewitz and his position. And could you tell us Clausewitz's view on the object of war?
Well, Clausewitz was Clausewitz was also a statesman. I mean, he was very good about making sure you understood that there was more to fighting and winning a battle than actually the fighting itself. You know, he had the golden triad. He would talk about your ability to govern after you won a battle. He also talked about your ability to win the hearts and minds of the population. He also talked about how you had to return commerce back to a population in order to continue the fight, because you could not overextend back then. They had small armies. They would take cities during his time frame. But the trilogy that he pushed and supported his ideology with had a lot to do with being above and beyond just the fighting piece. In actuality, in combat, fighting is the easy part. I mean, it's the dirtiest part, and it's the hardest part. But in mid-actuality, it's the easiest part of winning the overall battle that you're involved in. Because, if you go back to Sun Tzu, you go back to Jean Monnet, you go back to all of these great guys, they will tell you that the fighting is only so much in the spectrum of operations. Peace operations, nation building, and all the other things that are inherent to that allow you to actually turn a state back over to its government, a new government, or you continue to occupy it.
And in Najaf, you destroyed the will of the enemy without having to destroy the city.
Exactly, because, you know, Ayatollah Sistani was up there, and that is the grand Ayatollah Sistani, the Mosque of Ali. He's the most important, he's the senior Shia cleric in the entire planet. And so if you want to win a heart and mind, that's the guy to do it, because he has religious power to give an order to all of the Shia on the planet Earth. So if you win that guy over, you can leverage his power.
And his power leverage saves thousands of lives in the long run.
Well, we finally got him to give us a religious proclamation or a fatwa on the morning of the 4th of April. He ordered the Shia to lay down their weapons and no longer resist the coalition, and they did so. And the fighting in southern Iraq stopped, allowed us to get into Baghdad a lot faster than we had anticipated.
And what was the day then on arrival in Baghdad?
The actual day was...
I remember it was a Thursday, but I can't remember the date.
The 9th of April sticks out in my mind. I think the 9th of April was considered the day that the Thunder Run was done by David Perkins and 2nd Brigade of the 3rd ID, and they just stayed. He was just going to do a show of force, and he got in there, and he just said, "The heck with it, we're staying."
Boy, that was a great and a grand day. There have been so many components of this, and a lot of people have watched that on the news and tracked that as we go along. But I wanted to ask you, what happens to the morale of our troops when members of Congress give speeches on the floor or go to places like Syria? And I understand that this might be a delicate question, Colonel, because you need to remain the liaison here.
Yes, sir.
But let me rephrase this in a way a little more delicate.
Okay.
And that is, I'm concerned about the morale of the average soldier that is over there that watches C-SPAN.
Yes, sir.
And maybe hears people stand on the floor of Congress and say, this war is lost, it's a civil war, we have no business being there. What happens to the morale of the average soldier when they hear that?
Well, sir, you know, let me just relay the story, the reason I came to see you. Because you were a congressman, you were on the floor, and I was in Panama practicing a rehearsal to take down the Panama Canal and watching the forces on the ground doing that this last year. And that was an exercise that we do to make sure that there was a coalition that's prepared to assist if something terrible was to happen to the Panama Canal, which the whole world has interest in. And I walked into one of the guard stations at 3 o'clock in the morning. Guess who I see on C-SPAN up there talking about troops? And it was you. It was Mr. Steve King, my congressman, at 3 o'clock in the morning talking about troops. And that's why I sent you an email and said, I must find you and shake your hand. The things you hear on C-SPAN, if you have enough energy left at the end of the day after patrolling Baghdad to watch C-SPAN, not up there in the top 10 of things that we would watch, but we do watch it. We pay attention. And we feel right now that the American people are on our side. They know that we do this because but we are bound to defend and support the Constitution of the United States. That's what we all sign an oath to. We don't sign an oath to an administration. We don't sign an oath to a congressman. We don't sign an oath to anybody except a piece of paper, which is an ideal that we all sign and swear an oath that we will defend with our lives. And that's the process of how a president is elected, how a Congress is selected, how a judiciary system exists out there. And that those mechanics, as long as those mechanics work, we feel that we are successful. So we know there's going to be opposing differences of opinion up here. And I will tell you, for me, from my position, I can't talk about Private Jones or Sergeant Snuffy, but I can tell you that Colonel Hughes, I applaud the debate. I think there should be a debate. It's always nice when there's somebody who's going to be the devil's advocate. I had the Pink Ladies, the anti-war protesters, in my office yesterday. I invited them in, and we talked about the Constitution. And when they were done, I shook their hand, and I said, thank you for protesting the war. Not because I agree with you, but because I agree with the ideal that you can. And that's when I feel successful, because I've made that available for them to do so.
Colonel, because you fight, they can
protest
the war. And my mission on this is of course, opposite theirs.
Yes, sir.
In that you convince Najaf that they should surrender without a fight by defeating their will, the
yes, sir.
Imposing presence of the forces of the U.S. military, and 2,200 eyeballs of your troops looking down on that city.
Yes, sir.
I want to encourage you and your soldiers to continue this fight. I want to discourage our enemy. And when I can do that from the floor of Congress or through press or whatever way, I want to lift the will of our troops, and I want to discourage the will of our enemies. I think that's my mission here, Colonel. And you have understood, conducted, and articulated your mission very well here. And I thank you so much for being with us on Conversations with Congressman King.
My privilege, sir. Thank you.
We've been here with Colonel Chris Hughes, Red Oak, Iowa.
Please join us next time on Conversations with Congressman King. For more information on any of the topics mentioned today, visit the website at house.gov/Steve King.